Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Bob Dylan is almost 68 now and out with a new album. Historian Douglas Brinkley followed Dylan through Europe on his never-ending tour. His interviews became the cover story of this month's Rolling Stone, and it's quite a story. This hour on Point, Douglas Brinkley on Bob Dylan.
Oh, well, I love you, pretty baby. You're the only love I've ever known. Just as long as you stay with me, the whole world is my throne. Beyond here lies nothing, nothing we could call our own.
You can join the conversation this hour. It has been a long time since Blowin' in the Wind, since Blood on the Tracks. What does this man, this artist, this American mean to you? How do you see Bob Dylan? And what's your question on how he sees the world now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Douglas Brinkley has interviewed Bob Dylan for a cover story in Rolling Stone. Brave man in a way to do it, we'll ask him. It hasn't always been easy. Here's a little bit of Dylan. A 1965 press conference in San Francisco, the young Bob Dylan mocked questioners and members of the media as they asked him about the meaning of his music.
Do you prefer songs with a subtle or obvious message?
With a what?
A subtle or obvious message.
A message? You mean like, what song with a message?
Well, like Eve of Destruction and things like that.
Do I prefer that to what?
I don't know, but your songs are supposed to have a subtle message.
A subtle message?
Well, they're supposed to.
Where'd you hear that?
In a movie magazine.
Oh, my God.
Do you think of yourself primarily as a singer or as a poet?
No, I think of myself more as a song and dance man, you know.
You've got to love it. It's not easy. Douglas Brinkley is brave. That's Bob Dylan, 1965. Here he is in 2005, interviewed for Martin Scorsese's film No Direction Home, talking about how he, Bob Dylan, has been regarded by others throughout his career.
At a certain point, people seem to have a distorted, warped view of me for some reason. And those people were usually outside of the musical community. The spokesman of a generation, the conscience of this and that and the other. I mean, that I could not relate to. I just couldn't relate to it. As long as I could continue doing what it is that I love to do, I didn't care what kind of labels were put on me or how I was perceived in the press because I was playing to people every night.
Bob Dylan in 65, in 05. Joining me now from Austin, Texas is Douglas Brinkley in 09. He's professor of history at Rice University, the authorized biographer of Jack Kerouac, editor of two volumes of letters of his late friend, Hunter S. Thompson, author of many books of history and current affairs on subjects from Hurricane Katrina to Henry Ford. For Rolling Stone, he's profiled Ken Kesey, Norman Mailer, Kurt Vonnegut. His new cover story is Bob Dylan's America, and it's all about Bob Dylan's thoughts, interests, life, attitude, outlook. Now, Douglas Brinkley, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
How did this come to happen, sir? You're in with Bob Dylan in Amsterdam and Paris and I don't know what all. How did it come to be?
Well, I was going down to Brownsville, Texas to look at the border fence that's being built. And I had read a little news item that Dylan's new album, Together Through Life, was just coming out. And so I wrote a proposal to Jan Wenner, the editor of Rolling Stone, who's a friend of mine. And I've, as you just mentioned, I've profiled people like Kurt Vonnegut and Kesey and Mailer for the magazine before. And I said, look, I'd like to really interview Dylan as an American historian and approach it not with the wrong kind of probing personal questions, but really kind of make some tapes about everything from his childhood in Hibbing, Minnesota, and the Iron Range, to why now he seems so infatuated with Texas and Texas iconoclasm. And so I wrote the proposal, and then Mr. Dylan said, yes, I'd like to talk to Doug Brinkley. Jeff Rosen, a manager of Bob Dylan, kind of got me organized, and I flew over to Paris and went to the show there, and then headed to Amsterdam. And at the Intercontinental Hotel in Amsterdam by the Amstel River, Bob and I would sit in a suite on the second floor in the evenings and talk and make tapes. And I had a very natural rapport. He was a very gentlemanly, and he responded to all my questions. The reputation is that he isn't that way, but I encountered somebody who wanted to talk about America and history and where he is now on the eve of releasing this album.
Let's get a little Dylan music in our ears as we look at where he stands in that history that you talked about him with. This goes all the way back to what many people see as, I don't know, maybe his greatest album, a work of genius. It's been called Blood on the Tracks, 1975. Here's Tangled Up in Blue.
I had a job in the Great North Woods, working as a cook for a spell. But I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a being employed. Working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind. And I just grew tangled up in blue.
Bob Dylan, Tangled Up in Blue, from Blood on the Tracks, 1975. Douglas Brinkley, I kept thinking about this song as I read your interview. This is still a kind of rambling man after all this time. When you think back to that sound, which was so big in its day, and surely not the only one, what do you hear of America running through that, and how does that rambling man character still run through Bob Dylan himself these days?
Well, as you mentioned, Tangled Up in Blue, the song playing right now, was part of Blood on the Tracks, and that was about Bob Dylan's separation with his wife, Sarah. It was recorded first in New York and then back in his home state of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And Tangled Up in Blue now has become almost a busker anthem. If you travel around Europe, you'll see people with six-string guitars singing this song. It's the anthem to being footloose and fancy-free, of rambling, of living with only change in your pocket. It resonates a lot with Jack Kerouac, who we talked about some, and Dylan was telling me how much On the Road meant to him when he was young because of the movement in it, the way the language moved, and the thought of going from place to place. Dylan is very interested in location. I think he writes a lot of his songs, particularly for where he's at. He's an artist, a poet. He's sensitive to his surroundings. And so you'll find him talking about different American cities in various songs. For example, on the new album, Together Through Life, there's a wonderful song about if you ever go to Houston. And in that song, he not only talks about the city of Houston, but also Dallas and Austin and San Antonio. And he calls out a lot of American name places in his songs, as you would with Stephen Vincent Benet, a poet who used to do that a lot. Allen Ginsberg would do that quite a bit. But it's part of kind of a beat generation ethos, that song, I think, Tangled Up in Blue, that you can find yourself when you travel and find solitude. And it was another part of our conversation, is how much Bob Dylan enjoys solitude. He doesn't want too much of it. Of course, he's performing over 100 shows a year, but he likes his time to himself. It gives him time to think away from the clutter and the maw of our, you know, industrial world. It gives him a time to be spiritual and to work on his art.
And he's still out there. I mean, you describe it and others. He's got his mansion in Malibu, and I don't know what all for homes. He's got 9 grandkids, and he pays attention to them, we're told. But you've also got him just out in the world, out there in his hoodie sweatshirt, kind of unrecognized, and among other things, sort of tracing down the footsteps of childhoods of other artists that he admires, everybody from Elvis to Neil Young.
Well, you know, I used to do a class I called the Magic Bus, and I used to take college students around the country, and we would read Willa Cather while in Nebraska, or read Flannery O'Connor in Georgia, or John Steinbeck in California. And I talked to Dylan about that, and he does a very similar thing with musicians. I mean, he will go to the hometown of Leadbelly, or he'll visit the exact recording studio you know, of Otis Redding, or go to the towns of Roy Orbison or Buddy Holly in Texas. One that I thought was very unusual, because it's a contemporary of his, is he told me he was on the bus going through Canada and was in Winnipeg and decided to go find the boyhood home of Neil Young. And he actually went to the street and the house and went up the stairs to the house and walked all around and felt that he got the essence of Neil Young. I asked him if he'd ever told Young that, and he said no. He meant to send him a note, but my Rolling Stone piece would be the messenger to inform Mr. Young that Bob paid him about the highest compliment you could pay an artist.
That's a pretty good greeting card. We'll talk more about it, but plays, very important to Bob Dylan at 68, maybe more important than ever.
I think so. I mean, when he was in Amsterdam, you know, this is not somebody who doesn't know where he's at.
Yeah.
I felt he was, you know, went all over. He went to the museum to go study the Rembrandt paintings. He came back and we talked about how much he loves Rembrandt. He got very passionate about art. We talked a little bit about American artists that he likes, like George Bellows, his famous, of course, boxing paintings, but also Thomas Hart Benton, those gigantic, heroic murals that he did of American life. But when I raised the name Andy Warhol, he gave me a look like I had just said something rotted from high heaven.
Not so much
love.
Well,
he said Warhol as a cultural figure, but not an artist.
Yeah. Douglas Brinkley, stand by. A great interview with Bob Dylan in Rolling Stone. We're going to hear a lot more about it. Here's I Feel a Change coming on from Dylan's new album, Together Through Life. You can join us. What's your sense of Bob Dylan at nearly 68? What does Dylan, over the arc of his life, his work, stand for to you? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And I'm reading James Joyce. Some people, they tell me I've got the blood of the land in my voice. Everybody got all the money. Everybody got all the beautiful clothes. Well, you're coming down High Street, walking in the sun. You make a dip and rise a harder. She's the one, Jolene. Jolene.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bob Dylan and what he's told historian Douglas Brinkley in a big new interview in Rolling Stone. Dylan is out with a new album, his 33rd studio album, 46th overall, Together Through Life. It's number one in the UK, first time that's happened in, I don't know, maybe 30 years. And he has been talking, not least, in fact, in depth with Douglas Brinkley. You can join the conversation. What's your sense of Bob Dylan at nearly 68? What does Dylan, over the arc of his life, stand for to you? What's your question about Bob Dylan today? Is this our Walt Whitman, our singing Kerouac, our folky rocker, a honky-tonk man? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Behind us, Jolene from Dylan's latest album. Douglas Brinkley joins us from Austin, Texas. Bob Dylan thinking a lot about Texas lately. We'll talk about that. Let's get a call right here from San Francisco, California, and David. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, Doug. Hey, you guys. Hey, I'm the guy, Dave Whitaker, who Dylan talks about, the Beach Bengali, who first gave him Woody Guthrie's autobiography, Bound for Glory, back in 1961. Talk about a long, strange trip. I was there at the beginning, Minneapolis, Minnesota, way back then. So I look back now after 50 years on this adventure. And what I wonder, is it seems to me that he seems like a guy who's well on endless tour, seems really isolated. And I always wondered, does he still have friends? He talks about that we're just a dream to him now. Looking back at those early days when he was out and about from Minneapolis, Minnesota, Bond to Blonde on Blonde, when he was still out and about on the streets of Minneapolis and the Lower East Side. And I just wonder, and also I'm also the one who pushed to introduce him to Jack Kerouac and the Beats, because I'd been in San Francisco in 1951.
David, you're moving history there with all that. But let us pick it up. I mean, 100 tour dates a year, his new lyrics, he's got lyrics talking about the mountains of the past. But how does he look back now? I mean, those are mountains. And why does he tour so much? He's sometimes mocked by music critics for that, Doug Brinkley.
Well, what a great call to get, for starters.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I think the mention of Woody Guthrie might be the answer to the question. I mean, when Dylan moved to New York City back in January 1961, his big goal was to meet Woody Guthrie. And he actually played Guthrie songs for Guthrie at his hospital bed when Woody was suffering from Huntington's disease.
Yeah.
And Dylan sort of inherited the Guthrie baton of the wandering troubadour, singing the American songbook, writing songs that mattered, that stuck to your rib, songs that people would remember 100 or 200 or 300 years from now. And I think it's really only Woody Guthrie whose accomplishment in songwriting in the American vernacular that Dylan's really on equal footing with. I think Dylan's probably the top songwriter of 20th century America. And I mentioned in the piece taking into account people like Gershwin and Irving Berlin. But Dylan touring right now, he really wanted to make this point at a couple of our tape sessions. He hit on the same point again. He doesn't like this being called the never-ending tour. It's a media creation in his mind.
But it's 100 gigs a year since, what, the last half dozen or more years. That is a kind of
looks
literally.
But he says, I'm a tradesman.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you his answer. It's, look, I'm a tradesman. Yeah. That, people, what do they want me to do? I didn't write my songs to just go sit in a house.
Mm-hmm.
I love performing. That's what I do.
Why not?
And that he gave many examples, like is Billy Graham the never-ending preacher? Or is Paul Newman, was he the never-ending race car driver? Or
right.
Duke Ellington, was he not supposed to have his orchestra in his 90s? What would people like me to do? I enjoy performing. It keeps me alive. I have fun. And it answers the question of friendships. You know, Bob's doing all these shows. After each show, he has people backstage, and he spends as much time with them as he wants to. I was there when President of France Sarkozy was there with his wife,
Carla Bruni.
And so he's getting distinguished guests like that. Sometimes old friends, Lenny Kravitz actually was there backstage, and they would talk about things. And I think he does that. So he interacts almost daily with people. And then he has his group of friends on the road, his band, his people that are his managers, people that he's working with. And then he goes away when he's not performing. He demands privacy. And he spends a lot of time with his children and grandchildren and tries to stay out of media glare. Dylan may have been the one who was right about the modern media. I mean, we hear how he didn't want to answer foolish questions that he played at the outset of the show, because the media can be very trite and kind of malign one's artistry and integrity. You could sometimes feel like when you do a TV show, you lose a little bit of your soul every time you're out there. Dylan picked up on that early. Maybe in the long run, he was the one that was right about how to deal with reporters, and meaning in this modern era of overinformation, you have to cling to your privacy as if it's a rare family heirloom.
He may have been exactly right, or at least right to pick the interviewer very carefully indeed. He chose you here. Let's get a little sense of that again. This is another famous scene from that documentary, Don't Look Back. It was filmed this on Bob Dylan's tour of England in 1965, and here's Dylan haranguing a reporter from Time magazine who tried to interview him.
I know more about what you do, and you don't even have to ask me how or why or anything, just by looking, you know, than you'll ever know about me, ever. I mean, I could tell you, you know, I'm not a folk singer and explain to you why, but you wouldn't really understand. All you could do, you could nod your head.
You could be willing to try.
No, I couldn't even be willing to try, because it would be, it's, you know, there's certain things which, every word has its little letter and big letter. No, it's not pigeonhole.
No,
it's not the word,
not
at all.
Important.
You know, every word has its little letter and big letter, like the word no.
Yeah.
You know, the word no, K-N-O-W.
Yeah.
Okay. You know the word no, capital K-N-O-W?
Yeah.
Like, each of us really knows nothing.
Bob Dylan on tour in the UK in 1965. What did he want to talk about with you, Douglas Brinkley? What was on the tip of his tongue? What did he really want to dig? You're a historian. You know,
well,
you're going to make it last.
He wanted to and this never-ending tour. I think that it's been a tattoo to him for about 20 years.
That framing, you mean? That
the framing of it. I don't think he wants to go to the grave saying, and for the last 40 years of his life, he was on a never-ending tour. Mm-hmm. That came across. I think he wanted to talk a lot about the parts of history he loves. We had a wonderful conversation about Walt Whitman and what Leaves of Grass means, and his fears that Whitman's America's over, that in some ways it ended with Western expansion, but that bigness of America, the open-heartedness of Whitman, this sort of pouring of empathy, a kind of older America that may be gone. He definitely wanted to talk about Texas quite a bit in the new songs. You played a minute ago, I Feel a Change Coming On, and he has that wonderful line that you played where he says, I'm listening to Billy Joe Shaver and reading James Joyce. Some people say I've got the blood of the land on my voice. And I talked about Joyce and literature and the books he reads, but also Billy Joe Shaver and his love of the Texas outlaw music genre. People like David Allan Coe and Billy Joe Shaver and Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings and Buddy Holly, Leadbelly, and then Doug Somm, who had a band called Sir Douglas Quintet in the 60s and 70s, and Dylan had sang a song called Wallflower for Doug Somm. And Somm, where I'm at here in Austin, is considered sort of the progenitor of the cosmic cowboy scene in Austin. And he was supposed to be, I never met him, he died some years ago in New Mexico, but he was supposed to be a real sweet, special, warm man, Doug Somm. And Dylan misses him quite a bit, and we talked about that.
Let's reach back a little bit, talk about the outlaw ethos in some of Dylan's earlier music. Here's Knocking on Heaven's Door, 1973.
Mama put my guns in the ground. I can't shoot them anymore. That long black cloud is coming down. I'm knocking on heaven's door.
Bob Dylan, 1973. Douglas Brinkley talking with him now. I mean, there's the outlaw thing going on, but as I read your piece, there's also a kind of, there's an emphasis on morality. There's even an emphasis, and it may be linked to the Texas, focus, obsession? I'm not sure what you'd call it, on patriotism.
Bob Dylan loves America, and when in the 1960s, when he was being anointed the head of the counterculture, he moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and recorded country-flavored albums, and it angered people. He started spending a lot of time with Johnny Cash. Cash was pro-Vietnam War and was a Richard Nixon supporter, and here Dylan, who was supposedly the head of some kind of counterculture with Cash, he went to Europe with his group, The Band, and would drop an American flag behind him and play at a time when anti-Americanism was high in Europe. This is a person who has deep love of the United States. He has since childhood his love of our folk songs and our folk poetry and of our better nature. His love of, we talked about people like Henry Ford and Theodore Roosevelt, and he's deeply steeped in American history. I would recommend a song that he wrote called Cross a Green Mountain that came out. He actually wrote it for a Ted Turner Civil War movie that didn't do particularly well. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible song of a soldier during the Civil War. He listens to our songbook. He knows all the songs of Stephen Foster and Jimmy Rogers and Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker. He is just a walking encyclopedia of American music, and it's out of a love of these places that the people come from. He loves the cities of San Antonio and that it has its own music sound, or the Kansas City sound. So for him, we might talk on a program like this about Charlie Parker. Dylan would think of where Parker grew up and the streets he walked and what Kansas City was like back then. And he takes time to read old newspapers and looks at old photographs. And so in Texas, it means a lot of things to modern culture. But to Dylan, it's the stories, the folklore of Pecos Bill or John Wesley Harding, the gunslinger, or O. Henry's short stories, or Nelson Algren's stint through Texas. every state in the United States, Bob Dylan has a take on it, and it's a kind of a folkloric take, and he feels that that American folklore, I think, is stronger than the Time magazine cover, or the Wall Street Journal today, that it somehow will resonate 1,000 years from now, our folk traditions, more than mainstream media culture.
He surely is right. I mean, in a way, let's hope so. There's the folkloric, but there's also, I mean, he's plugged in right now. We'll talk about George W. Bush. You go way back, 1963, he had his Talkin' John Birch Paranoid Blues, mocking the conservative John Birch Society, was supposed to play it on the Ed Sullivan Show, walked off when he wasn't allowed to. Let's listen back.
I was feeling sad and kind of blue. I didn't know what I was gonna do. The communists was coming around. It was in the air, they was on the ground, it was all over. So I run down most hurriedly and joined the John Birch Society. Got me a secret membership card, went back home to the yard, started looking on the sidewalk.
Bob Dylan, 1963. Let's get a call from Basie, Virginia, and Ina. Ina, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Hello.
Hi.
I hope I can talk. I don't talk very well in a public arena. But,
you sound great to me, Ina. What do you think?
Well, I just want to say that, well, I was born in Texas, and I lived most of my life in Texas. I'm a transplant from Houston.
Hmm.
And I was born in 1936, and I said for years that I didn't cry at birth because I needed oxygen. I cried at birth because I looked up and I had been born in Palestine, Texas. This was like the Bible Belt back then.
Well, okay.
And
how about
it
Dylan?
Probably still is. And moved to Houston when I was 15. Still thought I had been born on the wrong planet until Bob Dylan started writing his music. And when his music started hitting the airwaves and even underground, I was getting everything he wrote, and I knew that I was on the right. I was at the right place doing the right thing.
And what was it about Bob Dylan that made you feel like maybe this planet was yours after all?
I almost feel like that goes without saying. I mean, he was talking my talk. He was talking about my walk. He was saying the things that I was seeing. And he was saying it so profoundly. I used to take, because I'm not of that generation. I'm 73 now.
Mm-hmm.
But I was taking kids, from high school and in the early 60s and making them listen to, to some of Pete Seeger's and Bob Dylan's songs. And so that they would, one young boy joined the Peace Corps, which upset his family pretty much, but
Ina, we've got it. You say he saved your life. Thank you so much for calling, Ina. Douglas Brinkley, how does Dylan take to that? I mean, he'll have detractors, but he'll have many who see him as a kind of, music divinity, cultural, walking king. How does he respond to that?
He performs and sells out everywhere he plays. All over Europe, it's a big deal that Bob Dylan's come to town. You mentioned that his new album, Together Through Life, is number one in the UK. I believe today it's going to be number one in the United States.
Wow.
And the fact that he is he's going to be 68 this month and has the number one album, with all that's going on out there in the music industry and younger recording artists, that people keep turning back to him means there's something in his music that's not transitory. People recognize that he's built not a cult following, but something much larger than that, an international following, that a Bob Dylan song means something. He's kept the integrity factor high, and it's come through a lot of hard knocks. You played a little bit of that Paranoid John Birch Society Blues. Mm. What Dylan had made clear to me was, that was the defining moment in a way. I mean, people always talk about when he plugged in his electric guitar at the Newport Folk Festival and it moved from folk to rock, and there's this seismic change in America. Well, really, for him as an individual, it was when Minnesota was watching the Ed Sullivan Show. He rehearsed that paranoid John Birch Society blues all day. And suddenly, at the last minute, CBS censors said, you've got to do a Clancy Brothers song. And Dylan froze for a minute and either had to play the Clancy Brothers or walk. He walked, and from that point on, he was an outsider. He was on James Dean Boulevard, if you'd like.
We're talking about Bob Dylan. Douglas Brinkley, historian, has just interviewed him for Rolling Stone. A great interview. We'll hear more. This is Forgetful Heart from Dylan's latest album, Together Through Life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I lay awake and listen to the sound of pain. The door has closed forevermore, if indeed there ever was a door. I'll get the blues for you, baby, when I look up at the sun. I'll get the blues for you, baby, when I look up at the sun.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Bob Dylan, about to turn 68, and here's Shake Shake Mama from his new album, Together Through Life. We're talking about Dylan today and what he's told historian Douglas Brinkley in a big new interview in Rolling Stone. You can join us. Do you picture him out there wandering through the old homes, hometowns of Elvis, Buddy Holly, Leadbelly, Neil Young? Do you picture Bob Dylan reading Plutarch, Marcus Aurelius, Grant, Obama? What's your question for Douglas Brinkley on Bob Dylan now? He's been talking with him for Rolling Stone. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Michael in Naples, Florida. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. What do you hear? What do you know?
Well, here's the thing. Like any one of a million people on the planet, I'd like to say that I'm the biggest Bob Dylan fan on the planet, and it's really strange. What do you say about Bob Dylan in a 2-minute radio phone call when it would take years to discuss everything? Just a few things. I'm 47, and I work with a bunch of people who are much younger than I, and I'm constantly saying that you guys, I mean, I feel like my father, but I'm constantly saying that you guys really, if you discredit Bob Dylan because he has a poor singing voice or an atonal singing voice, you really don't appreciate music. I mean, they're all film students, so they go back to the works of D.W. Griffith and they pay homage to that, but they won't concede that Bob Dylan, and this is my take, Bob Dylan is the seminal influence on American rock and roll music in general.
And when you say that, what are the 20-somethings? What do they say back to you, Michael?
They all come back to me and say, I can't stand the sound of his voice. Okay? I can't stand the sound of his voice. And my take on it has always been, especially of his early acoustic recordings, all the protest songs and the like, and I would say to them, my answer to that is, does it occur to you that maybe it's that voice that's necessary to sing those lyrics? I could go on and on and on and on and on. But,
Michael, I mean, we got it. Number one fan on the planet, Douglas Brinkley, and he's up against his 20-something, maybe 30-something colleagues who say, oh, wait a minute. Does Dylan have an opinion on this?
Well, first off, his shows are filled with young people. I mean, it's not just, fathers and sons, but grandsons. It's very cross-generational. So I think Dylan's connecting to people. I agree with the caller. I mean, I think the Bob Dylan lyrics, if you get the collected lyrics of Dylan, it's sort of our era's Leaves of Grass. Some of them aren't the quality of Whitman's poetry, but others are. And I think the fact that he keeps adding to that lyric book the way Whitman kept adding to Leaves of Grass, it's a worthwhile analogy. Dylan should win a Nobel Prize for literature. He has really influenced the way novelists, poets, filmmakers, painters, artists all over the world. I think his voice and his message has probably been more transformative than any other modern artist in a global way, and that maybe we're getting into the season now after Dylan did his own book, Chronicles, that people are starting to realize that we have one of these great artist whose name, you know, we talked a lot about when he was young, and Dylan loved Carl Sandburg. Mm. And he got out in a car from New York and drove down to North Carolina and banged on the door of Mr. Sandburg to give him a copy of the Times They Are Changin' album. And he wanted, Mr. Sandburg was 86 years old and gave him about 20 minutes. But Dylan is our Carl Sandburg. He, you know, he is our Woody Guthrie, and he's in our midst right now. And so it's exciting to realize we have an artist that constantly keeps changing and surprising, refuses to throw in the towel, and is relevant. And he's relevant not just for academics talking about him, like somebody like myself, but yeah. The popular marketplace. When he releases an album like Together Through Life, and it pops at number one, and the song Beyond Here Lies Nothing is being played all over the place.
I loved your recounting of that visit to Carl Sandburg, having a lot of Swedes in the family. We made pilgrimage there when he had his goats, he and his wife there mm-hmm. in North Carolina. I sat on that front porch on his lap when I was much younger than Bob Dylan, just a tiny kid. But to think of Bob Dylan standing there, you know, saying, here's my album, I'm a poet, you know, he wants to tap right into that, and you bring it all. You also mentioned literature, and you've got him reading Plutarch and Tacitus and Marcus Aurelius and Uncle Tom's Cabin and I think Barack Obama.
Yes, and books are a big part. What he does during his day is read, and he reads a lot of history, and he's reading some of the Romans right now. But he also draws a lot. He has a sketchbook, and he sketches, and then he takes bright colors in his paintings that he does are just starburst. I mean, they're you know, Van Gogh like bright colors on them, and it makes me understand how he's full and whole, because some of the lyrics on Together Through Life are very very dark and gloomy in many ways. But you know, he's his art is just a celebration of what he's seeing as he travels. So whether it's a rail yard or an old tenement or a you know, person on the street, that there's just a great humanity in his drawings. And it I think when you combine it with the songs he's writing, you realize that this is an artist that's in control of what he wants to do.
There's a little bitter or ironic streak through here as well, a track called It's All Good. He picks up on the phrase that's come into parlance and kind of throws it back in the country's face, saying, you know, more or less, you think it's all good? Look around. Let's listen from Together Through Life, Bob Dylan. It's all good.
Big politician telling lies. Restaurant kitchen all full of flies. Don't make a bit of difference. Don't see why it should. But it's all right, 'cause it's all good. It's all good. It's all good.
Bob Dylan sings in this song, people in the country, people on the land, some of them so sick they can hardly stand. Everybody would move away if they could. It's hard to believe, but it's all good. What about that stripe, Doug Brinkley?
Well, it's a very funny, dark song and very mischievous.
Yeah.
And I think Dylan smashed that cliche, it's all good, and once and for all. I catch myself saying it. And since the song's come out, I've just bottled it up. I stopped myself midway through.
It's all over.
So, yeah, and I try to figure out where he picked, you know, whether he just picked up hearing a lot of young people in particular say it, and where he picked it up from. But I didn't really get an answer from that. I should say some of the lyrics on this album are co-written with Robert Hunter, who was with the Grateful Dead and co-wrote the songs with Jerry Garcia. John Perry Barlow was Bob Ware's songwriter, mm-hmm. and Robert Hunter was Garcia's. And Dylan loves Jerry Garcia. They both knew the American Songbook, you know, the songs like Shenandoah,
yeah.
et cetera, together. And
love it.
So this, much like Desire, where Dylan had collaborated with the songwriter, he does so also on this album.
Let's go to Petal, Mississippi. And Phil, hi, Phil in Mississippi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, sir.
Two points to make. Number one, I keep buying Dylan's albums. And ever since the late 70s, I keep being disappointed. They're mediocre at best. I have to admit, I haven't heard this new album in its entirety. I've just heard what I've been able to pick up on NPR over the last few days.
Yeah.
But he's no different than... You know, early Jackson Brown was great. Early Elton John was great. And they hadn't had a decent album in the last 20 years either. And the second point is this, is that quality of singing voice has nothing to do with popularity in music, because Bruce Springsteen can't sing worth a crap. And for that matter, neither can Willie Nelson.
You're laying it right down there, Phil. Thank you very much for your call. Douglas Brinkley, what about it, the then and the now? I mean, he had his famous motorcycle accident in the 70s. He came back with it with a different voice and a thinner voice. He doesn't, Bob Dylan does not disguise it. It is an aging voice. He's not trying to be forever young here. It gets just about as gravelly down in Tom Waits and even more gravelly territory on this album. What do you say to Phil?
Well, I think in the 60s, Dylan had some masterpieces like Bring It All Back Home and Highway 61, Revisited, Blonde on Blonde. You mentioned Blood on the Tracks earlier. He had a period where in the 70s, and particularly the 1980s, where some of his albums were not up to par. But recently, he's had a great resurgence. He's producing himself as Jack Frost. And if you listen to, and it's not just me saying this, I think his most critically acclaimed albums have been in recent years, Modern Times, Love and Theft, songs like Working Man's Blues, for example, or Nellie Moore that he's written, and Mississippi. These are considered some of his standards, some of the great Bob Dylan songs. So one of the reasons we're here talking about him on National Public Radio is he hasn't become a has-been. And, you know, in our interview, it was very interesting. I had seen a book called The Encyclopedia of Bob Dylan, and they under Elvis Presley, it said nobody knows whether Dylan had ever met Elvis Presley before.
Yeah.
And so when I went into the interview, I thought, well, I'm going to clear that up. I'm going to ask the source. And I asked Bob, and he said, look, I worship Elvis. He was my guy. But by the time I had an opportunity to meet him, Elvis had recorded three Dylan songs, Blowing in the Wind, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, and Tomorrow's a Long Time. The Memphis Mafia, so to speak, wanted to introduce Elvis and Bob together, and Dylan refused because he didn't want to see that bloated, overaged, you know, Elvis not in his prime, not, you know, at his best. And I think Dylan fights to not become like Elvis became. He wants to be relevant. He stays in shape. He boxes. He wants each album to be top. There's a great competitive streak in him. He doesn't want to be a punch-out artist. And I think the critical community will tell you he has not done that in these last albums. All of them are getting 4 stars or 5 stars, if you like.
Here is the kind of one of the back in the day anthems, like a Rolling Stone, 1965.
Ah, you never turned around to see the frowns on the jugglers and the clowns when they all did tricks for you. Never understood that it ain't no good. You shouldn't let other people get your kicks for you.
Highway 61, Revisited. Allison in Allberg, Vermont. You're on the air. Hi, Allison. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, Bob Dylan's not really my generation. I'm 38 and born in 1970. I like him a lot. I really do. And I swear, one night when I was watching TV, I saw him on a Victoria's Secret commercial.
Yes, you did.
And I just want to know why, because that seems very... I don't know. It seems very odd to me that he did that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Allison. Douglas Brinkley, what do you say? Bob Dylan and Victoria's Secret, what up?
Well, there have been a number of them. You know, Cadillac, he's done something for. Look, Dylan's view of way he wasn't joking when he was telling that reporter he's a song and dance man. He's played at West Point. He plays in front of a Pope. He'll play at a casino. He brings his guitar, harmonica, his band, and he plays. And he doesn't see his songs as being just people have wanted to paint him as being a folk protest singer rallying against the man or against capitalism. And it's just not the case. That was what people in the counterculture 60s saw Dylan. The new left wanted to see that and found that in him. But Dylan is somebody who has tried to make it in American life as a songwriter. He writes songs. He writes songs for movies. Many of the songs for this new CD are going to be in a movie, which I write about in the piece. And some of his best songs have been commissioned. So he's somebody who is a working artist. He's not trying to be the prophet of the left. So I think when he makes those decisions, it's on a product or a company that he feels he can believe in, like Cadillac.
Or underwear.
Victoria's Secret lingerie. I believe that song was Love Sick that they had from, and it was a well-done commercial. I think his managers make sure that they like any artist, that they connect them with a product that does the least amount of damage.
We may still scratch our head a little bit right there, but hey, life is diverse. Let's go to Vic in Norfolk, Virginia. Nick, you're on the air.
Okay, earlier in the show, you posed the question, do Dylan's songs make a statement? Well, at a concert here in Norfolk, Virginia, soon after the U.S. invaded Iraq, Dylan, he gave a concert and he sang Masters of War. This is a big military town, and to sing that profoundly anti-war song here in Norfolk was a statement that I admired Dylan very, very much for. I'm a 24-year veteran, and I really admired him for singing that. I'd like to see Bob Dylan considered for the Nobel Peace Prize, or, to second what an earlier caller said, at least the prize for literature.
Vic, thanks so much for your call. Our time is short. Douglas Brinkley, how does he see himself? You know, an artist for Rushmore, a honky-tonk man, both?
He sees himself as a bluesman, somebody who can carry his own guitar and sing toward the end, somebody like Willie Dixon or John Lee Hooker or Leadbelly in the folk reign, somebody like Pete Seeger. He wants to have integrity. He refuses to be seen at the end as a man who had no morality or was just a ticky-tack artist. So he wants to go out his own way. He's highly individualistic, which is very much in the American grain. And his love of, we talk quite a bit about Minnesota, and he seems almost, even though he's traveling all over the world, in many ways he's a hometown boy. The way he talks, almost with a glint of joy in his eyes about Hibbing and Duluth and Lake Superior and the North Country. And, you know, the state of Minnesota now is starting to really pay homage to Dylan. It's also the state of Sinclair Lewis and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Judy Garland. They've had many talents from there. But I saw a show of Dylan's memorabilia and at a Frank Gehry Museum that's at the University of Minnesota campus. Dylan had spent some college time at University of Minnesota. But I think you're going to see that state really adopt Dylan as their own, even while Dylan is spending time in Texas. He told me the polka bands in where he grew up in the North Country of Minnesota are very much like the accordion bands along the Texas-Mexico border, that the sound is the same. It's just the language is different between Polish and Spanish.
Well, we can hear that right here in this track from Together Through Life. And think, as you have it, of Bob Dylan out there in his hoodie sweatshirt, maybe along the concourse right next to us. Douglas Brinkley, it's always great talking to you. We are out of time here, but it's a great interview in Rolling Stone. Thanks for bringing it to us. Thanks for being with us from Austin.
I really enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Historian Douglas Brinkley on Bob Dylan. Here's This Dream of You. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I turned and looked again by the dream.